May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm Patrick Collins, Kate Aronson for Jermaine Monroe. Due to the multiple errors in this case, we seek a new trial on his behalf. This court held 2 weeks ago that in-court identification by a witness is probably the most dramatic and persuasive evidence. And in this DNA era, that certainly has proven to be a true statement. Eyewitness identification evidence is extremely powerful, which is why due process requires that proper procedures be used when an eyewitness identification is made by a witness. In this trial, the chief investigating officer, Detective Smith, admitted from the witness stand that she violated every standard police procedure and principle when she obtained the eyewitness identifications which were germane to this case. The first was Shamika Brown. She was the girlfriend of the victim, Andre Farrell. This shooting took place outside of Mini Mart. Shamika Brown was in the car with her two young children in the back seat. Mr. Farrell was about to get back in the car when he was shot multiple times. Shamika Brown testified that she saw the shooter for, quote, a brief second. Her testimony at trial indicated that she only saw about a quarter of his face, the right side from the below the eye down to the jaw. She consistently said that he was a 5'5" to 5'7" black male, caramel complected, and it bears noting that Mr. Monroe is 6'1". She told an officer at the scene that she thought the shooter looked like her co-worker's boyfriend. That set in motion two things. One, a police investigation into that assertion, but more importantly for today's purposes, a series of unduly suggestive procedures which were engaged in by the police. First of all, they put in an interview room at the old Newcastle County Police Building. They put Ronnie Saunders, the aforementioned co-worker's girlfriend, in the room right next to her, and it's obvious from the videotape that they're communicating with each other the whole time. There was also a window in between the two rooms which was papered over with some brown paper, and they could clearly hear what was going on in each other's rooms. They interviewed Ronnie Saunders, and then they interviewed Shamika Brown. Detective Smith came at her multiple times. Are you sure that your coworker's boyfriend doesn't know the victim? Three separate times she was asked that question, trying to establish a connection. Also, she was shown a picture of a Crown Victoria, which was a car that she knew was driven by Ronice's boyfriend because she had gotten rides to work from Ronice previously. And they let her keep her cell phone, which allowed her to kind of document the suggestibility, ironically, because she made multiple conversations. She talked about a white lady at the scene who told her that the shooter was driving a Crown Victoria. She said to an unknown person, "They're coming in here telling me about Ronice and the Crown Victoria. They came in here and showed me a picture of Ronice, and that got me to thinking." She also says on one of the calls, and this is all before the identification is even made, she also says before the identification to someone, "I don't know who it was. I'm just saying what they are coming in here telling me. I'm just saying what people are saying, and I'm going with it."
All of this was presented to the jury, wasn't it?
It was all, yes, Your Honor.
And so these arguments were all made to the jury?
Yes.
So, what is the legal issue for us?
Well, the legal issue was whether this is evidence under due process that should have even been before a jury. And I think the dramatic effect of eyewitness identification evidence definitely underscores that. that it has significant power and of persuasion to a jury. Yes, those questions were asked on cross-examination, but the legal issue here is whether the motion to suppress the eyewitness identifications made in this case should have been granted. We assert that they should have been granted because of the unduly suggestive police procedures that are used. That's the legal issue. These identifications should have never made it to a jury for consideration because the jury convicted Mr. Monroe of the murder offense, and there was really not a lot of other evidence of significance, such as forensic.
Let me make sure I understand what you mean by these identification. Do we have one or two issues here? Are we talking about the suggestiveness of pretrial identification and therefore no evidence of the pretrial identification should have been heard by the jury? Are we talking about those suggestive pretrial identifications tainting an in-court identification? Are we talking about both?
Both. And multiplied by two, because there were two eyewitnesses to which we made similar assertions and filed motions to suppress. Those were both denied after a hearing, and the witnesses were permitted to testify. When Shamika Brown was shown a photo lineup, Your Honor, she was told, if we showed you a picture of someone that we believe may have been involved, do you think you could identify the person? That is patently suggestive because it tells the witness that the person that the police are planning, are suspecting of the crime, is in this photo lineup, which any procedure.
So when you say if we show you a photo, it was a photo among others.
Six-pack lineup, yes. And we presented at the hearing, not that the Newcastle County Police is necessarily bound by it, but the Department of Justice Guide to Eyewitness Identifications, and Detective Smith agreed that they were all good procedures to follow. And one of those procedures is you don't want to create any preconceived notions before showing a lineup. As a matter of fact, there's a recommended preamble before giving a lineup to say you may or may not recognize anyone in this photo. Take your time, etc.
There have been Delaware cases that declare that a clear in-court identification can cure flawed pretrial identification. Is that still good Delaware law?
It is, but it doesn't apply to this case. Reason being, with respect to Shamika Brown's identification, when she chose Mr. Monroe from the six-pack, she somewhat equivocally chose him by saying, I don't know, for some reason it just looks like him. And then Detective Smith said, so that's the person who shot? Yes, definitely. Here's why the in-court identification should have been excluded. Right after that, Detective Smith informed Shamika Brown, well, he's the person who shot your boyfriend, attempted to kill your boyfriend last year. He's the person who killed your boyfriend tonight, and we're signing warrants for his arrest right now. And she wanted to explain his name and the fact that they knew each other. By that I mean the defendant and the victim, and that there was an issue in the past, etc. Well, with that endorsement by the police, there can be no assurances that what the witness is doing from the witness stand is pointing at a person and say, yes, that's the person I saw. It's more likely that what she's doing is, well, based on the fact that Detective Smith told me I had the right person, that's the person. And so that's the reason that the in-court identification should have been suppressed as well. But I will, to answer Your Honor's question, I will agree that there are some cases that a tainted out-of-court identification does not necessarily give rise to a excluded in-court identification.
The theory seems to be in some of those cases that you get to cross-examine that identifying witness about the very point you just made. Is it correct, by way of example, that you today are identifying this person more because what the police said to you and the way in which the pretrial identification was handled than because of any confidence in your part today, independent of all that, identifying the person in the courtroom, or words to that effect.
I certainly agree that that question can be asked and probably was asked at this trial, if I remember correctly. The problem is, how much confidence can there be in the answer?
Well, actually, the problem is, what's the constitutional impairment? That's what we need to know. What's the principle of law that says we don't have confidence? What prevents us from having confidence in that as a matter of law?
Well, as a matter of law, it's a due process violation under Younger versus State and all the other cases that address this issue, that when there's an unnecessarily suggestive lineup procedure or photo identification procedure, let's call it, we move to step two and look at the Neal v. Biggers or Manson v. Brathwaite factors and try to determine whether there's a serious likelihood of irreparable misidentification. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Well, keep in mind,
help us by tracing those factors and demonstrating, by putting facts to the factors, why this was unnecessarily suggestive and the in-court identification was tainted.
Well, the unnecessarily suggestive factors, I think I've already addressed some of the facts showing who the car.
Now apply those facts to the factors that you just explained.
Okay. Well, the first one is opportunity to view. By her own testimony, she said she only got a quick, her quote was, a quick second to look at the shooter as he was running away. She's in a car in the passenger seat facing forward. She turns to look and sees the shooter through the back window of the vehicle. She said that she only got a side look at his face, and in court, through demonstrative evidence, it was shown that what she saw was the right side of the face from approximately below the eye down to the jaw. And we took at trial the photo identification that was used and covered over certain sections of it, and she agreed that that was the portion that she saw. Next factor, degree of attention. Well, she testified at trial that while the shooting was going on, she was in, of course, a state of panic as there's shots being fired at her boyfriend right next to her. And then after the shooting, even though she did see the shooter running away, she testified she's worried about her kids in the back seat. Are they shot? Are they hurt? Both of her kids, she testified, were screaming and crying, as one might expect. So her attention was not solely on trying to get a good look at the shooter and identify him for later purposes. Her attention, naturally, as a mother, was diverted to her children. Accuracy of her prior description before the photo lineup is given, that's the third factor. She was consistently accurate, not only to the police, but to every single unknown person she talked to on the phone. 5'5" to 5'7" individual, wearing a multicolored baseball hat with different colored panels around the head. Sometimes she said red, white, and blue. Sometimes she said red, white, and green, but she was consistent in that fact. Caramel complected. She never varied from that description. And although the trial judge held that her description was fairly accurate, that doesn't take into account that the defendant in this case was 5 to 7 inches taller than the person that she saw shoot her boyfriend. Next factor is the level of certainty. It doesn't appear from the record or from her testimony that she was particularly certain until she was told by the police that she had picked the right person. Then she became very certain. And so all four of those first five Neal versus Biggers factors, they all militate heavily in factor of a substantial likelihood of misidentification. The last one is length of time, and in this case that really wasn't a factor. She made the identification within a few hours after the shooting occurred. So there wasn't a gap in time where she could be influenced by fading memories and things like that. But four out of the five factors make it quite clear that based on her distraction and her limited opportunity to view someone who's running away through the back seat of a car, that the unnecessarily subjective procedures did have a significant effect on her identification.
Mr. Collins,
yes, sir.
My problem is that with eyewitness identifications, you can sort of divide them into three categories. You can have those that are very clear, certain, you know, no evidence of any suggestion by the police, that's white. And then on the opposite side is black, so to speak. You know, there's a lot of suggestion, limited opportunity to see, you know, the alleged shooter. You can name whatever other complicating suggestive factors you want, but clearly it's over the line, and the should be suppressed. And then you have some arguable suggestion and some arguable limitation to observe. That is, you've got a fuzzy gray area. Is there a presumption? Is there a rule? Is there some guide as to how we're supposed to address those gray area IDs?
Well, I think the trial court is supposed to start with a blank slate and apply the two-part rubric based on evidence heard that's established in Younger and the other cases. If the identification isn't unnecessarily suggestive, then we never get to the other factors. If it is, then we move on and say, were the due process rights of the defendant imperiled by this unnecessarily suggestive procedure? And that's when we apply the factors which I was answering the Chief Justice's question about.
So your point is that the pretrial identification was unnecessarily suggestive and prejudicially suggestive, and therefore, if we look at these factors, before the in-trial identification could be admitted into evidence, and the court had to be confident there was an independent basis for the in-trial identification that was free of any taint, and that did not happen in this case.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. With respect to the Catherine Meyer identification, she was a customer at the liquor store across the way in the shopping plaza. The same rubric applies, and the same police procedures, although perhaps not quite as egregiously, but the same police procedures did in fact happen. She never actually made an identification. She sat and looked at the photos for, I think we clocked it at about a minute and a half, shaking her head from side to side. She finally pointed to a photo, which happened to be the defendant's, and said, if I were just flashing at it, if I had to flash, I would say him, but no. She was asked what that no meant, and she said, well, it meant that I was confused or I was unsure. And then she finally said that she picked Mr. Monroe because he was the darkest complected. So we argued pretrial that her identification was so equivocal that it should not be termed an identification at all. But again, if Detective Smith hadn't said that's the right one, what happened was Ms. Meyer said, did I get the right person? And Detective Smith said, yes, you did. Without that, there could possibly be an in-court identification. Is the person you see here today, do you recognize that person? And Ms. Meyer could have said, well, this all presumes we lose our motion to suppress, which we did. Yes, I would know him like I saw him yesterday. That was definitely the person I saw. Or she could have said, I'm sorry, I just don't know. She could have said any of that. The problem is when the police confirm or give commentary about the identification, that taints the identification for trial. And, you know, as the detective admitted, she didn't follow proper procedures in either one of these identifications. And so you have two identifications. The Shamika Brown one was significantly unduly suggestive. The Catherine Meyer one was clearly tainted by the fact that Detective Smith confirmed that she got the right person. So we're really talking about four identifications, two for each person. And in this case, based on what happened and the detective's own admission that she didn't do it right, this is one of those on the continuum that goes beyond the gray area. This is one that is so suggestive that it is violative of Mr. Monroe's due process rights. And that's why, for that claim, a new trial should be ordered. If the court doesn't have any other questions about the eyewitness identification, I'd like to turn to another
Please.
Claim, if I may. We filed a post-trial motion for a new trial based on the fact that due to a rather unique chain of events, the jury heard evidence about a prior alleged necklace robbery, which was not proved at trial by plain, clear, and conclusive evidence. The day before the attempted murder allegation, so January 25, 2006, the victim, Mr. Farrell, Ronald Wright, Jonathan Wisher, and another person that the police never identified, went to the GNP Deli on 27th and Market. Wisher stays basically dozing off in the car. Ronald Wright is in the deli when something happens. And as the court held in granting, well, in permitting the 404B evidence as proper motive evidence in this case, Ronald Wright didn't see the defendant outside. He didn't see any necklace robbery. Wisher, he saw Kason Wright and other people running away. He didn't see anything more. In letting the evidence in, the trial judge held, I look particularly to the 3507 statement of Kason Wright. Kason Wright was an alleged participant in this robbery, along with allegedly the defendant. Jonathan Wisher could identify him. He knew him and identified that he had an automatic handgun in his hand. Now, Kason Wright, the day after, was involved in his own shooting problems about a block away turned himself into the police. And to try to help himself, he made a statement implicating Mr. Monroe in this shooting. He was very uncooperative in the pretrial hearing. He wouldn't even agree that it was him on the videotape, etc. The court did view the 3507 videotape and decided to permit the evidence based on the Kason Wright videotape. Post-trial, after Kason Wright pled the fifth and never did testify, this is a very Reader's Digest version because there was he took the stand three or four different times. He asked for counsel. He asked for his mother. He finally decided to plead the fifth, and he was taken away. So the jury never heard about the necklace robbery from Kason Wright. All they heard was from Ronald Wright and from Jonathan Wisher, who really didn't see anything.
Well, that's not quite correct, is it? Doesn't the record show that Ronald Wright and Wisher, although they didn't identify Monroe as the actual robber, did place him at the robbery scene?
That is what the court held post-trial, Your Honor, but I would submit that the record shows otherwise. Jonathan Wisher didn't know Jermaine Monroe and never at any time, pre-trial, during trial, identified him as being there, just some other person along with Kason Wright running away. Ronald Wright, no relation. Ronald Wright, 3 years later, says that it was Jermaine Monroe. Interestingly, he had ample opportunity to tell the police, that's the guy who I saw at the necklace robbery, because he gave a statement to the police in September of 2007, 6 months after the murder of Andre Farrell. He had his own legal trouble, so he was being questioned by Wilmington police. Even then, he never said it was Jermaine Monroe. He used the phrase, he saw Kason Wright, a guy he was locked up with back in the Plumber Center, and, pardon the expression, some other nigger. He never identified Jermaine Monroe until it was the day of trial, and he, at that time, decided that the person that he saw was Jermaine Monroe. So I think the record reflects that the identification of Mr. Monroe made by Ronald Wright was highly equivocal.
It may have been highly equivocal in the sense that it took place for the first time at the trial, but that's an issue of witness credibility, isn't it?
Well,
I mean,
it is.
You're essentially arguing to us an issue of witness credibility that was resolved, presumably, by the jury.
Well, the question here is, I'm on 13 seconds. Can I just finish my answer?
Please? Yes, please.
The question here, Your Honor, is, does it rise to the level of plain, clear, and conclusive evidence? A 3 years late identification made by someone who has a clear interest in making sure that his friend who was murdered comes to justice is not, it doesn't rise to the level of plain, clear, and conclusive. And the trial court held that in the pretrial opinion. The trial court held, I look particularly to the Kason Wright videotape, neither Ronald Wright nor Kason nor Jonathan Wisher saw a robbery. It was only after the post-trial motion was filed that the trial judge relied on the Ronald Wright testimony. Thank you.
I do remind you that you've gone through your rebuttal.
About 35 seconds worth.
No. You had 36 seconds over. I just don't want you to jump up and act as if you have rebuttal time. You don't.
Oh, I thought, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought that the clock was giving me what I had.
Not when it's red.
Unfortunately, that's a lesson I've learned quite a few times, Your Honor. All three issues raised by the defense in this case had been fully litigated pre-trial and post-trial. And the decisions by the trial court are given great deference and will only be reviewed for abuse of discretion. And as Justice Jacobs just noted, really what they want to do is have this court undo the credibility determinations both of the trial judge in making those rulings to begin with, for instance, when he had looked at the unduly suggestive claim and when he looked at the claim that, in fact, the 404B evidence was not plain, clear, and conclusive, and then the determinations by the jury, because the jury eventually found, well, yes, Jermaine Monroe was, in fact, the person who shot and killed Mr. Farrell that day.
Mr. Wallace, on the question of the admissibility of pretrial identification evidence or the in-court identification, do you agree with the framework for analysis that was set out by your colleague?
The framework, yes, except to one point. The first thing the court does, both the trial court and this court in review and determining whether there was an abuse of discretion, is determining whether it was impermissibly suggestive, in that meaning that it gives a rise to a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. Even if the court finds that they get over that hurdle, though, then the second question is, even if there was an unduly suggestive lineup or there was an unduly suggestive identification procedure, can the court be assured that there is other evidence of reliability? So that second question ends up coming to the when the person is sitting on the stand and says, yes, that's the person I saw that day. That's when the court looks to the Brathwaite factors on reliability. So it's not just if you don't hit the first hurdle, you're home free, or you do hit the first hurdle, you're home free, because then there's the second question of reliability that can come from the other factors.
Well, here, in regard to either of the two, I'll call them, for lack of a better term, civilian witnesses who made in-court identifications of the appellant, do we get past the first hurdle or not? Was the pretrial identification array followed by the commentary by the police officer, did it create the aspect we look for of unnecessarily suggestive?
The state suggests no, Your Honor. And the reason for it is this. If we look to the first witness, Shamika Brown, this wasn't somebody who, for instance, is in a bank and a robbery occurs and a total stranger comes in without a mask and sees them for a second and says, oh, yeah, I can pick that person out, no problem. This was somebody who was familiar with her, not familiar by name, but knew the defendant, to be Ronnie Saunders' boyfriend. She didn't know about the animus, apparently, that was between her own boyfriend and Mr. Monroe before. In fact, when the detective had asked her questions about that, she consistently said she really didn't even know that there was a connection between the two. But she did know Mr. Monroe as Renice Saunders' boyfriend. So that's how she recognized the face. And certainly when we talk about whether or not somebody then can identify someone they know, even if they know them by face and they know them by their relationship, there's a whole, it's a whole different animal than when that person comes in and is just identifying somebody they've never seen before in their life in a circumstance like this. And so when she first introduces that it is Renice Saunders' boyfriend that I saw, it's going to be different the way that you do the identification. Really, if you try to apply the test that Mr. Monroe wants, you can almost never identify somebody you already know or go through the steps that Detective Smith did. Detective Smith didn't just say, oh, it's Renice's boyfriend. Well, then here, take a look at this photograph. Is that him? That's not what she did at all. She followed steps to try to ensure that, in fact, she was getting the right person, that she wasn't suggesting it. And the judge in the pretrial proceedings made that very clear and went through all of the steps that were necessary. As to Ms. Myers, the state would suggest the same is true. There was no undue suggestion. It was, do you think you can? And she says, no, I don't know that I can. Are you willing to try? And basically she did. So we would suggest that they miss on the first hurdle. They trip over that first hurdle. And you don't even need to get to the second. But to the extent that the court disagrees and we do get to that second, there is reliability. For Shamika Brown, it's the very factors I talked about to begin with, and that is this was somebody she knew. So when she sees them in that circumstance and we have to remember what the whole story here is, she actually saw him pulling out of Durr's in the white car just beforehand. And then he comes back on foot. So it's somebody that she had just seen and that she knows, at least by relationship. And then that person comes back, and she sees him again, and then she sees him as he's running. So we would suggest as to the reliability on Shamika Brown, if we had to get to that hurdle, that also is a stumbling point for Mr. Monroe.
Well, is there a connection between the two? If we assume factually what was represented to us is documented in the record, that Myers showed some uncertainty when she saw the photo array and expressed that she was really picking out the person with the particular colored skin, and then expressed uncertainty by saying, did I get the right one, or words to that effect, and the police officer says, you did. Let's assume for a moment that most reasonable people would say his answer to her question was unduly suggestive, and you get to the second prong. What's the relationship between her in-court testimony, relying on what the police officer had confirmed for her, and this element of otherwise reliable based on what?
Well, Your Honor,
she's expressed uncertainty. She hasn't identified the person clearly as the person, features, height, weight, whatever portion of the photo showed, shoulder to top of the head. She's really identifying more based on color out of a singular group of people, not multiple photographs, but a singular group. How can we be confident that other evidence suddenly turns that into a reliable in-court identification?
Well, first, Your Honor, I think that there is one fact that was interjected at trial, not during the identification point. If I am correct on the record, when there's the actual photo lineup and she indicates some unsurety, that's not when she says, oh, and I'm only picking him out because of complexion. I believe that was during cross-examination during the trial when they were trying to attack her photo identification, and she said, well, I think I picked him mostly because of complexion or the photograph. The problem in whenever you have photographic lineup versus live lineup is this. We've all seen pictures of ourselves, and we say, oh, that's me.
well, now you just have a disappointment, that's all.
For some of us, more than others, recognition. but when you talk about a live situation, and she had seen this person live and then sees them again at trial, certainly you may recognize someone live more readily than you are in a photographic lineup. More importantly, I think the judge had weighed all of the factors appropriate, and like I said, I don't believe that that complexion part of the equation was there pretrial. I believe that those were questions asked during cross-examination. But if we get to the reliability, what we do have is that Ms. Myers, saw him twice, actually, because she saw him first backing away and then saw him after she went into the store to, say, call 911 and came back out, saw him running at Lexington Green.
But even though she saw him twice, she was very hesitant about her ability to identify him.
Yes.
And then she picks a photo, and the police tell her, you got the right one. Doesn't that take us out of, kind of almost any further analysis, because now it's been planted in her head that she has the right person, and she doesn't have to think about it or have any doubts anymore because she's been told?
Your Honor, I it's a troubling factor, but I don't know that it takes it all out. Because what happens then is that she's at trial, and she's cross-examined. And the questions as to whether or not her identification of him is reliable is fully put for the jury.
Well, I'm confused about that, because I thought the whole issue is, should it have been before the jury? You know, in the case we decided a couple of weeks ago, we draw the distinction between a suggestive pretrial identification and an in-trial identification. So here, isn't the legal issue whether she should have been permitted to identify in the trial? And to answer that question, if the pretrial identification was suggestive, the judge has to be confident that she has an untainted basis to permit an in-trial identification.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you need to resolve all of that before you ever get to cross-examination.
And I believe that the trial judge did. And the trial judge had the witness before him at the proceeding to determine her level, the level that she may have been suggested, had the actual detective there to question all of those things.
Well, all of those questions go to suggestiveness. Justice Berger's question and my question is, if she couldn't identify him in the photo lineup, having seen him twice at the scene, and then she's told that she has the right person as the photo lineup unfolds, what other evidence is there that she could identify him that's untainted?
Well, I think what we have to say is her memory of him as she is sitting live in the courtroom before him. Because
is that on the record that she said something to the effect, I wasn't sure when I looked at the photographs I could identify the person, and in fact, when I looked at the photographs, I wasn't certain. But now that I'm here in court, I know that's the person, and I know that independent of what anybody ever said to me, because clearly that's the person. Did she say anything to that effect?
No, Your Honor. I don't know that it was unfolded quite that way. I'd have to relook at her testimony to be sure of that, but I don't believe that it unfolded quite that way. Sometimes it does when you have somebody who's uncertain in their photographic lineup, and sometimes it does not.
Well, it only unfolds that way when the questioner knows the answer to the question. You don't ask questions when you know the answer is going to be harmful.
It depends. Your Honor, I can tell the court in talking to or in examining many ID witnesses, and I know Your Honor sitting through many ID witnesses, strange things happen on the stand also, where they,
your questions to avoid strange things from happening. So if you clear if there's any danger of Ms. Myers saying the same thing in court that she said at the photo array, you don't ask her a question that will draw that answer.
Correct. And she was fully cross-examined about this. There's no doubt that the jury had the full ability to determine the credibility of her identification. And the state suggests respectfully that when there is that, and I guess I get back to what was my initial point, the defense here tries to undo that credibility determination by the jury when the judge had first, when they had been first unsuccessful with the judge, and the judge had heard those witnesses pretrial to determine that he
made it. I don't want to belabor this. Maybe I just don't understand the law in this area. So help me out. I was under the impression, if we assume hypothetically, and there was a suggestive pretrial identification, the court makes a determination before the witness does the in-court identification, and that there's an independent basis that's untainted. I didn't know that you just went into permitting the in-court identification and let it all be resolved by cross-examination. So my question for you is, assuming there was a suggestive pretrial identification, what was the untainted basis for letting the witness testify?
But, Your Honor, if in fact we stop at step one, and that is there's a finding and of an impermissibly suggestive that gives you a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification, then Brathwaite makes no sense, because what it says is even if you have that, then what you do is you go on and say, under the circumstances of the case under which this person made the identification or saw the act that she has to identify the person from, is there evidence of reliability that even with that, quote, taint, we should let it in? The problem is that if Your Honor says, once you find that taint, you can never get there.
No, I understand that. Tell me what the evidence of reliability is.
I think the evidence of reliability in this circumstance is one, that she had two opportunities to actually see the person. It was broad daylight. She was about 20 yards away, I believe the evidence showed. She saw him both walking in the parking lot, then running at Lexington Green. She gave a clear and detailed description, which is one of the things that one of the Brathwaite factors of reliability, that never changed. And it, in fact, only noticeably differed from Brown's. Their identification, you know, height, weight, all those factors, was noticeably the same other than complexion. They differed in the way they would have described complexion. So, you know, those were the factors that went to reliability, and I believe that even if one were to say, well, we believe that there's some level of suggestibility from that first hurdle, that, in fact, there was evidence of reliability that the court looked to. And so it was properly before the jury. I suggest once it was properly before the jury had more than sufficient evidence and more than sufficient factors to weigh in determining whether or not they believe that identification to be reliable. And they may have said, no, we're not going to base this on Myers, we base it on Brown. But we don't know how they would have resolved that. But certainly they saw they had that opportunity. They had full cross-examination of Ms. Myers about her surety on the identification.
So, if I understand it correctly, where you have in-court identification that's based solely on an earlier out-of-court identification, the court has to be a gatekeeper and determine whether the pre-trial identification is reliable enough to go to the jury. And that involves two inquiries, correct? One of them being, was there unnecessary suggestion on the part of the police authorities? If not, then that's the end of the inquiry, and the jury then hears the evidence, the in-court ID, correct?
Yes, sir.
If, however, the court finds that there has been unnecessary suggestion, then the court has to go further and inquire whether or not there's other the ID is otherwise reliable, or whether there are other indicia. And if so, then presumably that other evidence places the entire issue back into the gray area for the jury to resolve.
Yes, Your Honor.
Help me understand, Mr. Wallace, how do we deal with reinforcement? Let's assume, and I think the facts here show, that there was an identification and then there's reinforcement by the officer. You picked the right guy. And let's assume an egregious example. You picked the right guy, you know, we've got 100 other people that say that's the right guy, and just add on to that whatever you want. When does that cross the line and make, or does it ever cross the line, and make the in-court identification inadmissible?
I think, Your Honor, the only, you know, how much evidence or how much do the police have to enforce before they, or reinforce, before it becomes impermissibly suggestive, and that gets to the likelihood of irreparable misidentification. I guess I would suggest that it's a totality of the circumstances, because when you look at, and you, I guess, somewhat pull back in those reliability factors on the person's ability to observe and all of those things, I can't tell you that what the magic number is as to how much reinforcement there must be before it is impermissibly suggestive. I would agree with the court, there is some number, and that when that fact weighs so much more heavily, then we must be concerned. I don't think it meets it in this particular case.
Did the trial judge expressly address that?
I'd have to go back and look at the severance motion decision to determine whether or not the court specifically suggested specifically looked to that particular factor in determining how troubled or how much unreliability might have been infused if the police officer said, what happened was the police officer had her initial picture, and then there were questions after that. And the question would be, how much do we believe that that weighs towards potential irreparable misidentification? And I think you also have to weigh it against the other evidence of identification. For instance, identification by a person who knows the person already in this case.
One can assume, because the case law uses the phrase impermissibly suggestive, that a suggestive pretrial identification might be okay. It's only when it reaches impermissibly suggestive that it's not okay. The determination that it's not simply suggestive but impermissibly so, is that a conclusion of law or a finding of fact?
I believe that that's, you know, it's one of those mixed fact law questions.
I was a patriot,
but I would assume, but I would suggest that because it is, it would always be a de novo reviewed by this court as the impermissible. It's a question of law in the end, because it's a legal test.
I think that's right.
If there are no other questions of the state,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.